not going to name any names, but those cats up there in Orlando and up there in Connecticut, I would keep your promotion, your millions of dollars, because you step in the ring with one of these boys and, well, you'll be sent home packing, huh? All right. I didn't name any names. That being said, tonight, I am very, very lucky because I got to walk out with that belt. However, in my opinion, and I think a lot of people in that audience share with me, the real champion of this ring is that guy right there.
It's Review Away with John Pollock and Wei Ting. How are you doing today, Wei?
Doing great. Doing so well. How are you?
I am doing fantastic. I understand that you've gained quite the following on Draw Something.
Huh. Yes, I've had two people add me. I don't really want to talk about Draw Something. It's okay.
Well, it's a very popular app. Lots of people are loving
this. How many people have you added on Draw Something?
None.
Okay. How many people do you want to add on Draw Something?
Actually, I haven't even opened the app since we talked about it on Monday, so maybe someone did. Maybe. I don't even know what my username is on Draw Something, to be honest.
It's a lot of... I'm actually very impressed by some of the drawings other people make. I don't know how they do it. I know for me, like, the screen is very tiny, but I guess that's no excuse. It's just hard.
People are now having Draw Something parties where they come together.
Wow.
And they all play together in, like, big groups.
On their phones?
Yeah.
So you go...
But you're doing it with people in person.
But you all have your phones.
Yes.
So you're all gathered around playing a game on your phone.
Yeah. It's the social aspect of it. I'm sure there's talking. I'm sure there's a bit of dialogue going on.
A lot of my friends used to do LAN parties.
LAN parties?
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness.
LAN parties. They get together and they would bring their giant computers over to each other's houses, including their monitors. And they would have a big setup and they would just camp out.
I don't mean to stereotype, but is this is this unique to one particular race?
No, not really. I mean, there were white people, there were brown people, but of course there were Asians. I went to a predominantly Asian high school.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What high school did you go to?
Albert Campbell Collegiate.
Albert Campbell
Paul
Collegiate.
Paul Bernardo went to my school for a
time. Oh, yeah, you've told me that. I just never knew the high school you went to.
We also had a SARS scare at my school.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Did you guys have...
One of the students had it.
Holy shit.
Or one of the students' parents had SARS.
And what happened to him? Was he quarantined?
She was quarantined, yes.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah. What about him? Did he just come back to school each day?
No.
He would be in danger as well.
I'm saying she. The student was a female.
Oh, okay. I thought it was like a... Sorry. When I think high school, I assume everyone is a male.
Right.
Because that is the high school I went to.
Yeah.
It was all guys.
I guess she eventually came back. Yeah. I don't know. I don't know too much about it. But I remember City TV kind of being outside of my school... and doing some interviews.
You weren't interviewed, though.
No, I just walked past.
Oh, that's too bad.
Yeah. We also had a lot of gangs, like Tamil Tigers, I think.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
We had, I remember ninth grade. This was quite the introduction to high school for me. I was informed, like, the second or third day of high school that there is going to be a weapons fight at the subway. Are you interested? And I looked at him and said, no, I am not interested at all in a weapons fight.
No, you're into hand-to-hand combat.
Yeah, you don't need weapons. Come on. That's silly. That was when I realized, it was like, two people that have problems with one another. I mean, it's one thing to get into a fight with someone and you settle your problems and then you move on. But then it kind of graduated into, okay, well, now I'm going to bring my friends and they're going to have bats and someone's going to get seriously hurt. And this to me is ridiculous.
It's really stupid. It's like going to war.
It is. Over what?
Over what?
Yo, bro, you looked at me wrong. Like, what are the major issues a high school student is going through that requires a violence as an answer? What are the problems? Because when I was in high school, my biggest problems, I can't even think of them. It was trying to meet girls. That was a big issue. Yeah. I had zits at the time. That was a giant problem for me. And I look back in hindsight, I'm like, Christ. High school was a vacation of life.
Yes.
What would require this?
No, absolutely. It's very silly. And I think
there were people bringing knives to our school, and they would do random searches where they would evacuate the school and search lockers.
Yeah.
We never did have metal detectors installed, but yeah, it was crazy. Like, kids just get nuts at that age, I think.
I don't know. I'm not going to claim to be able to solve any type of teenage psychoanalysis on this podcast. I at that age, everybody's just kind of trying to discover themselves. People are very lost. And
maybe it's also because then when I moved on to university at Ryerson, and maybe it's because, like, this was radio and television, which is typically a very nonviolent group, I found.
Yeah.
To university, it was like everyone was chilled out. Everyone was, like, relaxed. Can you think of one time seeing a fist fight at Ryerson, where the student body is ridiculously higher than high school?
Yeah.
I just saw drastic differences from high school to university. University was the calmest experience. It was four relaxing years outside of, like, even the work. The work was a lot of fun if you're in the right program.
The story I've heard, I mean, compared to a lot of my friends who went on to go to, like, engineering courses or business courses, what's wrong?
There's no opening on my coffee lid.
John just went to try to take a sip out of his coffee, but there's no hole here for him to take a sip out of. This is the weirdest thing I've ever seen. It's like your coffee is trapped.
This is the weirdest thing I've ever seen.
Well, maybe this type of lid was specifically made to just...
to fuck with me?
Keep your coffee and not... Maybe you have to... Now you're forced to take the lid off, aren't you?
This is just... I'm sorry. I went from...
This is the greatest podcast ever.
Teen violence to...
We've hit about the 8-minute mark now, and nowhere are we near starting this review.
I won't lie, I'm not in the mood to talk about wrestling. I feel I've... body has just taken so much. My mind has taken so much. It's just like...
Why this week in particular? Because you do this every single week.
I don't know. I think it's because my schedule has recently increased. I've got a lot of other things going on right now that have made just everything... it's just I've got a lot going on.
And like outside of work?
Yes, outside of work. So...
Okay. So now you've developed a life.
No. I've not developed a life. I just have some other things that I'm tending to as well, just some other projects and stuff. But this week, for 2 weeks in a row now, I have come in to work on my day off to do this podcast. And in fact, for this show, I did go back and rewatch the main event because I did watch this event back when... back when it originally aired, but I did want to go back and watch the main event, and I did that this morning. And then I watched Ring of Honor from this past weekend, the show.
Mm-hmm.
It's just like, there's just so much wrestling.
There is.
And I'm thinking to myself, it's like, okay, I watched, a two-hour Raw on Monday night, and Paul Heyman came back. And 3 years from now, I'm going to have no recollection of this Raw. Gonna have no recollection of those 2 hours.
I don't have a recollection of a Raw from 2 weeks ago.
It's like we take in so many hours, but you only retain like a percentage, a very minute percentage of what you're watching.
Yeah.
How many wrestling memories do you have that are going to sustain? What happened on Raw way a year ago?
But
nothing.
But how many memories of anything that you do you retain? I mean, you listen to a song. I guess, I mean, maybe music's not the best example. But you watch any type of TV show. How much of it are you going to retain?
I think it's at the point where when you go into something knowing that this is a...
It's a waste.
This is already a wash at the start versus... perfect example. You and I were talking about going to see Avengers. Very excited to go see this movie because I'm hoping it's going to be a fantastic movie and that I'm going to talk about it afterwards and I'm going to have a positive 2.5 hour experience.
Yeah.
And that I will get something out of this.
Yeah. That's really the difference, I think, between people who, you know, being a fan and also or and being maybe a professional critic is that. As a fan, you get to pick and choose what you want to watch, and you can stop at any time, and there's no pressure to continue on when you don't feel like doing it. Whereas if you're a critic and a professional one, you have to kind of put that aside, and you have to watch everything and comment on everything, whether you want to, whether you feel like it, or sometimes when you don't. And I try to, for myself, like, I don't claim to be any type of professional critic whatsoever. Like, I like to still think of myself as a bit of a, you know, more along the lines of a fan. And that's why if I don't feel like watching something, I try my best not to.
Well, that's good. I think you have a much better balance.
It's much more manageable, definitely.
Like SmackDown right now, I don't know why I watch that show every week. There's usually a fun Daniel Bryan segment. And outside of that, it's a 2-hour show. What other television shows? 2 hours a week. Forget Raw.
Well,
SmackDown.
Okay, but think about it.
Watching a show 2 hours a week where nothing happens.
But think about a hockey analyst. They have to watch a lot more than that.
I don't know. Baseball. I was thinking about that the other day, actually, because I was thinking about all these hours I watch a week. And I can't imagine that hockey analysts watch every single game, maybe come playoff time. There is no way they are watching 7 games a night.
No, I'm pretty sure. No, they don't watch every hockey game. But let's say you cover the Jays or the Leafs. You're watching every Jays game. You're watching every Leafs game.
Yep.
In the case of a baseball,
a baseball beat reporter who's on the road with a team and taking in 141, 142 games a year,
yeah.
That's insane.
Those are a lot of
hours.
That
is insane. A baseball game is 3 hours.
Mm-hmm.
Jesus Christ.
Yeah, I don't know how those guys do it.
But there's people that love it. If I was assigned to go on the road and cover UFC at their current pace, I think I could do it.
What if you weren't on the road? Let's say you're just at home, just like a baseball reporter that just might
Well, that's what I'm essentially doing. I'm watching every UFC. Mm-hmm. I'm watching every Bellator. I'm watching every WWE event, minus the house shows. I'm watching every TNA show. I'm watching every Ring of Honor show.
Yeah.
I think it's comparable.
Yeah, totally.
And then I'm talking about it for X amount of hours on top
exactly,
of it.
Exactly, exactly. And but you're saying that there are days when you just think it's too much.
There's times when it's me and Jay were both talking about this on Saturday. He came to pick me up to head off to TSN. I picked him up at around 3 o'clock in the afternoon.
Yeah.
And we're on our way there. It's like a beautiful day out, and we're on our way to Scarborough to watch fights on Facebook for 6 hours and then talk about it for another hour.
Yeah.
7 hours.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like there's certain days you just start like, ugh, I could be doing a lot more than sitting in front of a TV.
Right, right, right. Yes, well, you could, but...
And then you know what you get at the end of it? You get people saying, the media, they're so negative. The media. I think the media is like the toughest job because it's never positive. It's always... how dare you critique us?
So you are criticizing the people who criticize the critics.
Yep, I am. That's what I'm talking about in terms of people who, you know, recently Ariel Helwani and Ben Askren got into this beef because Ariel watched his recent Bellator fight, and it was a boring fight.
Yeah.
And I'm a fan of Ben Askren. I enjoy his wrestling. Not a lot of people. It's not for everybody, but I enjoy watching Ben Askren. And it wasn't the most entertaining fight with Doug Lima, But afterwards, Ariel Helwani, he was critical of the performance on his show, and he talked about how he had some party he was at, and he skipped out of it to go watch this fight, and he was very disappointed with it. And then Ben Askren kind of threw some words at him on Twitter, saying, like, you've never been in the cage. You can't criticize.
Yeah.
I hate that argument. Mm-hmm. I just hate that argument because more times than not, I trust analysts who have never had a fight a lot more because they're very knowledgeable to the product, and they watch a hell of a lot more than a lot of fighters do. Yep. There are fighters who have no idea what's going on, especially the business end, much less just, you know, all the fights that are happening. Yeah. A lot of John Jones, last week on MMA Uncensored Live, he's like, I don't watch a lot of fights. Mm-hmm. I watch my stuff. I watch my opponent's stuff when I have a fight coming up, but I'm not watching stuff every week.
There was one part of that interview where he was looking to Mike Straka to confirm, you know, a fight that was coming up or a fight that had just happened. And I mean, that's the difference, right? Is that these people who cover the fights like yourselves, you are professionals. It is your job to watch everything, whereas the people that are just participating in it, their job is to focus on themselves. It's not an easy job, and I don't think there are people that will. It might seem like a dream job, and it really is in many ways. I'm sure you'll agree, but it's a lot more work than it probably looks.
It seems that it's when we praise something, that's great. We never get someone complaining on Twitter. How dare John Pollock say I had a 5-star match? He's never wrestled a match. I've never heard that complaint ever.
Right.
But if you're negative on something, then you have no basis for your critique.
Right. Why would anybody complain about a compliment? It's like when people criticize our podcast or criticize something like that. It's when you receive criticism, and you disagree with it, it bothers. It does bother. And you want to defend yourself. You might have a different explanation about why you did a certain thing or why maybe you disagree with it. And you feel the need to defend yourself, right?
Yeah, absolutely. People are defensive by nature.
Exactly.
No one wants to bring on valid arguments towards shortcomings.
I think the only time where you kind of have to step back and accept it is if that criticism is really thoughtful and a lot of thought was put into it. And, you know, sometimes you just agree, like, that person's right. That person made some very good points. I sounded really tired. I sounded really like I was very disinterested. And he's absolutely right.
You're a very even-keeled fellow.
Well, because I like to look at it from both sides, you know.
I think that's very good to do.
Yeah, you kind of have to. I mean, because I still very much see myself as just a fan, but also doing this, you kind of understand it from both perspectives, and it's all ego, isn't it?
Ego is, or what is it? The old saying, pride is the ultimate downfall of man, mm-hmm. And that is what I learned my entire fourth year of English literature, is that if you take pride and ego out of the equation, think of how much less conflict you would have in your life.
Yeah.
If you had thick skin when it came to Twitter comments,
you wouldn't have conflict. But ego and pride are also motivators. And you could argue that people would get a lot less done without that.
It can be used for good, but more often than not, pride is what leads to guys being disrespected and having subway fights. In high school.
Subway fights, right. Way to bring it back.
This was a good chat, Way. I enjoyed this.
Yeah. And thus concludes our review of Ring of Honor Showdown in the Sun.
Night two. Way, why did we not go to this show when we were in Miami?
We were in the middle of editing our pieces for the Fight Network. The night prior, we went to Access and we did a bunch of interviews.
That's right. And we went back to Access on Saturday.
Yeah, we went back to Access to get more stuff and also to...
It was also... Ring of Honor was like an hour away from our hotel, which when we had gone there... I had looked up the wrong address and thought it was 15 minutes from our hotel.
The way the streets are lined up in Miami, they're kind of confusing in that sense. But unfortunately, we missed it. We showed up at Ring of Honor at the fan festival the night before to get a lot of interviews with all the guys, which you can all see at the at youtube.com/FightNetwork right now. But unfortunately, we had to miss the shows just because we didn't have time.
Yeah, for those of you, we were putting these interviews up online leading into Border Wars. But right now, if you go up to where Wei said, youtube.com/FightNetwork, we've got interviews up there with Kerry Silkin, Kevin Steen, Nigel McGuinness, the Young Bucks, and Jim Cornette. So some cool chats there. I really enjoyed the Young Bucks interview. They were great, I thought.
They were very candid about their time in TNA and
the handshake
controversy.
Yeah. So some cool stuff to check out there, folks, to get you all set for a Border Wars coming up this weekend. But we are talking about their last iPay-per-view, which is going to be a trivia note as their final event on GFL.TV, which I was not aware of at the time, of course, because these events had not finished. So during my interviews, I got to plug Border Wars coming up on GFL.TV. Mm-hmm. Fuck.
It's a bit too bad, but the story coming out of these shows, aside from the great wrestling and the main match of the year candidate with between Elgin and Richards, is that
the Brownout.
The Brownout.
It should be a new heel stable in the company.
Or a finisher.
Yes.
The Brownout. Yeah. Just a ton of technical difficulties, unfortunately, suffered by Ring of Honor over the entire weekend for both shows, and it actually affected our viewing as well. Because we were only able to catch what was recorded off of the GFL feed.
Yeah, we watched the GFL feed that was put up a few weeks ago where they did not have the middle portion. So we only got to review here the two-hour edited down version. Since that time, Ring of Honor has posted both shows in their entirety up at ROHWrestling.com, which is their new home now for all their internet pay-per-views.
Okay.
And let's just hope the Border Wars does not have any technical problems this Saturday, because it's a new company they're with, and this will be their first time out going live on their website. So fingers crossed that technical problems do not persist for Ring of Honor, which won't affect us, but will affect others.
No,
we'll be there live.
They won't affect us, no. But speaking as people that have been plagued with technical problems ourselves in the past, we can totally sympathize. Listen, when you're working with a small budget, as small as I'm sure Ring of Honor's is dealing with, you're gonna be running into issues like this. So what can we do but cheer for them and hopefully no awkward silences.
So Showdown in the Sun Night 2, it took place during the afternoon of Saturday, March 31st, WrestleMania weekend, here in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, at the War Memorial Auditorium, which TNA ran just a couple of weeks after WrestleMania weekend and did not draw as much as Ring of Honor did.
Wow. Okay.
Now, granted, you also had WrestleMania weekend. You had a lot of fans in town, and they were big shows, but nonetheless, the War Memorial Auditorium, which me and Wei were able to find free parking at, just up the parking lot by the community center.
There's a community center. What type of community center was it?
Oh, it looked
It was like a community center for a croquet or something. A croquet center or something, something like that. Anyway, yeah, so we got to the venue the day before to shoot our interview. So we actually walked inside, and after walking inside, I thought it looked great. I thought it looked like a tremendous, it's actually like almost like a movie theater, the way the seats are set up. They're sloped, and everything was just basically facing a stage, like a high school stage. Unfortunately, as good as it looked in person, I don't think it translated very well on camera.
Nope.
Because the way everything appeared on camera, there were big gaps in the aisles. There's that big entrance that led you through the center of the stage. And it didn't come across in the way it sounded, too. For me, watching this show, I don't know what it was. I don't know if it was because the crowd wasn't really mic'd properly, or if it was just too cavernous of an auditorium or the setup, but the crowd just sounded so spread out. And even though they would chant intermittently, this crowd was like, no doubt this was the same crowd as what we saw on that Raw in Miami that time, right? So this was no doubt a hot crowd, but for whatever reason, it just, there were portions that were just so quiet, so dead, and then portions where, you know, you would hear the chants. But for the most part, I was really thrown off.
Yeah, this didn't have the same kind of a crowd atmosphere that their typical shows at the Manhattan Center produced, and that was something I noted as well. Kevin Kelly and Nigel McGuinness start off the show in the ring, and Kevin Kelly goes to discuss the card but is interrupted by Jimmy Jacobs, who had just turned heel and aligned himself with Kevin Steen the night prior, and they had been doing this year-long storyline where Steve Corino and Jimmy Jacobs had been these notorious villains who were now seeking the forgiveness of the crowd. And for a year, they had refrained from their violent past, and Jimmy Jacobs had been Steve Corino's sponsor. And in turn here, Jacobs had turned his back and had gone back to the dark side. And says that at Final Battle, when he had his spike, which has always been associated with Jimmy Jacobs, he froze before he could use it, and that's because he had an orgasm after being celibate for a year, and said the zombie princess arose.
That's his gimmick. He's the zombie princess?
Yes, the zombie princess.
Okay. Right. Yeah, I mean, I think Jacob's a good, interesting promo here. In this scenario, so Steen is the heel. And Steen has been trying to stop, convert these guys basically back into heels this entire year. And Steen succeeded.
Just the night with prior. Jacobs, yes.
Yeah.
And the night before, they had had Kevin Steen and El Generico. This was a big match coming off of the angle at Final Battle, where Steen had given a package pile driver to Generico off the apron through a table. And this was a gigantic injury angle at Final Battle. And this was Generico's return seeking revenge on Steen. And this is where the Jacobs turn took place. So Generico losing to Steen and now going after Jimmy Jacobs on night two. And this was an impromptu match with Generico running out. And they announced that ROH has approved the impromptu match.
For those unfamiliar, what exactly is El Generico's gimmick? And you know, describe him.
El Generico is a masked luchador who's white.
The generic luchador, yes. Well, he's not white. You're not supposed to know that.
No.
In reality, he is a French-Canadian.
Yes. So,
but he speaks
incredibly popular babyface in Ring of Honor, yeah, and all of the independents he works at. One of the busiest independent talents, very much in demand.
Well, on this day, didn't he work both the Dragon Gate show and the ROH show?
He did the surprise appearance, because this was Saturday afternoon, so he worked Friday night for ROH, Saturday afternoon for ROH, and his contract was up, and he showed up Saturday night.
His contract was up at this...
I don't know. I think he was finishing up with ROH on the Saturday afternoon.
Wow.
That was his last date with the company, and
that's
he was doing
amazing.
These two jobs on the way out.
There's no wait. It's just hours after his contract ended.
Yeah, because we were at the hotel where Dragon Gate was holding all of their shows, and I saw him around the hotel all weekend long, including the Friday when we got in. So clearly a deal was struck, and he showed up as a surprise Saturday night on the Dragon Gate USA card, worked that show, and then came back for his third shot on Saturday night doing commentary for $5 Wrestling with Colt Cabana and Marty DeRosa.
Very busy.
So
man is very busy. But as you mentioned, being able to see...
And we missed every one of his matches.
Yeah, unfortunately. We did catch him with... who did he wrestle? Michael Elgin. We caught him with Michael Elgin at the Wrestle Reunion.
Oh, that's true. We saw him a few weeks later.
Which was great. And just being able to see Jericho live a number of times, he really is like a fantastic babyface. Like,
he's awesome.
He's like a guy that... despite, you know, whether it be a crowd of maybe 30 or 100 or something, like he's just like giving, very giving with his physicality and with his body, and you just want to cheer for the guy because he just seems like a nice guy.
His comebacks are just awesome.
Yeah.
Like he just, the crowd ignites for this guy. They get behind him so well, and he's just a fantastic performer if you have not seen this guy, whether it be live or on iPay-per-view in any conceivable fashion. But here we go, Jimmy Jacobs and El Generico. And Jacobs hits his running elbow off the apron, and they compare him to Cactus Jack. And this is where Jacobs had the heat, and there were chants of Jimmy Swallows and then Little Jimmy directed at Jacobs. And Kevin Kelly apologizes for the technical issues from the night prior and saying, "We hope that we have everything in order for today." And Kevin Kelly, unfortunately, put a hex over this show by jinxing it here. Jacobs hits comes off the corner with an ace crusher, which just the physics of which he was jumping like off the corner going back into a forward moving ace crusher. I don't know how that would work. But it did here in pro wrestling.
If you apply physics to pro wrestling, I don't know if a suplex would be possible.
Or just throwing a guy into the ropes and him coming back.
Yes. For more. An Irish whip.
The Van Damminator. Yeah. That's just logic, actually, why you would hold a chair. And from there, we saw him go for a Generico stopped him and went for a brainbuster, gets tossed down, then runs into a half Nelson suplex into the corner by Generico. Jacobs applies his front guillotine, but Generico gets his feet to the ropes, and Jacobs grabs his spike, misses him in the corner, and Nigel says he doesn't want to see another orgasm from Jacobs. And Generico hits a half Nelson suplex for a two count, goes for the spike in the turnbuckle, but Jacobs rolls him up with an O'Connor roll, gets kicked into the corner, he grabs the spike, Generico ducks, and it ends with Jacobs getting behind and rolling up Generico for the clean win at 8:03. And this was a Generico's on his way out of the promotion-style loss.
Mm-hmm. So is he done with Ring of Honor?
It wouldn't surprise me if he's back, but he's currently not under contract to them. He has appeared on television because the TV was taped prior to this, but as of right now, Generico, he's working for a lot of other promotions at this point.
A very decent match, I thought.
Then we got a replay.
Then we got a replay, and I guess this was perhaps the least of all their technical issues, because in the replay, I don't think I've ever seen this before, but not only did we get a replay of the visual, we had accompanying slow-mo audio of Kevin Kelly's call in this replay as the live-action Kevin Kelly talks over it.
Horrible. Replays are not Ring of Honor's forte on these iPay-per-views. These were by no means as bad as Final Battle, which was just atrocious.
What happened?
First of all, it was a long show, and that, to me, just... the stuff gets to you a lot more. But even early on, they were going to these replays, and it was like out of sync. You had the slow motion voice. Yeah. It was like the wrong clip. And then they kept going to these throughout the show. It's like, guys, this is not working. Let's ditch the replays. You know, this is for every person that has bought this pay-per-view, they have it now. They have the pay-per-view for life. They can go back and watch a spot if it's that necessary. But you're going to turn new viewers off by these technical problems because, you know, I can be forgiving in terms of, you know, these guys are operating with a much lesser budget. But fans don't care about that. Yep. Fans are still, well, I'm still paying $15 here, and I'm coming in with ridiculous expectations of what a pro wrestling pay-per-view is. And whether that's fair or not, WWE and TNA they've just trained people's minds to expect a slick broadcast, and you have to compete with that. There is that indie feel that you can get away with, but stuff like this, people are not rooting for the underdog watching these replays.
Yeah. No, they're just pointing and they're just laughing.
Thankfully, this was not a trend throughout the show. I don't think they had that replay issue again on the card. Kelly and McGinnis then start discussing the talent performing the night prior and having to come back Saturday afternoon for another show. And the fans are chanting yes. And the embassy have been ordered to return the television title that they have stolen from Jay Lethal. And they've been given 24 hours to do so. And our next match features Cedric Alexander coming out with his tag partner Caprice Coleman against Tommaso Ciampa, who is, I don't want to say the Crimson of Ring of Honor. That's not doing this man justice. But he's doing an undefeated gimmick.
He's a big
built dude.
The Goldberg, the Ludwig Borga.
The Ludwig Borga.
Yeah.
I think Ciampa has come along much better than Crimson has.
Yeah, I seem to agree, even just from this one appearance.
And he, of course, has the embassy in his corner, that being R.D. Evans, Ernie Osiris, and Wei's good friend, Prince Nana.
He's not a good friend.
He came up to talk to you.
Prince Nana, we used to air fight Ring of Honor on the Fight Network, and one of our editors, his name's Michael. He's actually his family's from Ghana, so like he would watch these, he would edit these ROH shows, and afterwards he would just do the most perfect Prince Nana impression. I wouldn't even attempt to try it, but it was hilarious. And so I brought this up with Prince Nana last time we went to the ROH show in Toronto, and he got a kick out of that.
So the match begins, and Ciampa has a chair but gets stopped by the official as they fight to the floor. Alexander escaped the ring to avoid a running knee into the corner by Ciampa. And then Alexander drops Ciampa on his front for a two count. There was a big spot where Alexander suplexes Ciampa into the barricade, but a few minutes later, Ciampa throws Alexander into the post from the outside apron and then takes his knee pad off and delivers two running knees that send Alexander's head into the post, and then delivers throws him back into the ring and pins him very quick, 5 minutes and 25 seconds, and Ciampa gets the win.
Ciampa definitely seems like, at this point, a very solid mid-carder that's definitely poised to make his way through to the main event. I love the finish. I love his finish of exposing the knee. I like how, one of the great things about Ring of Honor and a lot of independents is that they put their emphasis on particular moves so that the story, like the storyline is all in the ring, and it's not something goofy like fucking spitting into your hand and using the hand to blind somebody. They're not just lame finishers. It could be a simple knee strike, but when you expose the knee, it makes it seem so much more deadly and dangerous.
A lot of people have noted that with Jim Cornette coming in, and they've changed the format up of the shows, that you get more matches like this, which, not a squash match, but you're not getting your 15-minute undercard matches where every match is designed to go out there and be a big match. Mm-hmm. I personally prefer this a lot more. I've said it 10 million times on this show. I am not a fan of the 4-hour marathon shows. I find that daunting to sit through. And by the time you get to the main event, it's like this challenge for the main event, and it's almost a handicap that you've got to follow all this stuff, and you could have a fantastic match, but people are burned out. I enjoy this, an undercard where you're building new guys for future shows, and it's kind of a showcase for some of your next guys. You've paid to come see Davey Richards and Michael Elgin. We're going to give you some strong matches in the co-features, but for the undercard, they're quick, they get guys over, it's a competitive back and forth, and then finish.
I agree with that.
No complaints from me. Caprice Coleman then goes after Prince Nana, but Ciampa hits him with his finish, which is Project Ciampa, which is a powerbomb onto his knees. And they play up how ROH has requested the TV title and that he's going to have to return it later in the show to champion Jay Lethal. Then this is where the editing took place, and we missed the next three matches. And that included T.J. Perkins against Fire Ant. We had Adam Cole against Kyle O'Reilly, the former Future Shock tag team. And there was another match in here as well.
The Young Bucks.
That's right. Yeah. The Young Bucks had a match. Who did they face? Do we know?
I'm going to look that up.
All right. Those matches are all, if you go up and order the show at ROHWrestling.com, you can see the show in its entirety. But as I said, me and Wei had the GFL feed from a few weeks back that did not include the edited matches. So we continue on, and then we are suddenly in the ring with Mike Bennett and Maria Kanellis. And Mike Bennett is chatting about his match and his win over Lance Storm from the Friday night, and saying that Lance is now at home nursing his injuries, which was not true. He was at the WWE hotel for WrestleMania, getting set to go to the Hall of Fame for Edge. And said that beating Storm is better than being a champion. And he calls Fort Lauderdale a hellhole. And he's going to go to South Beach and celebrate. And he calls himself the best in the world, just mocking the fans. It's a very good promo. And then Bennett and Maria made out for like the next 5 minutes in the middle of the ring, which led to the crowd chanting, yes, yes, yes. And this was the end of what they call their live Prodigy service announcement. And these are these YouTube videos that Mike Bennett and Maria put online. Their PSAs.
It's a shame that much of this promo was cut out in our version. By the way, it was Young Bucks versus the All Night Express.
That's it, yes.
It's a shame that I didn't get to see most of this Mike Bennett promo, because from what I've seen on the ROH show, he really has been a standout.
Maria has added so much to this guy. Yeah. It's like it's allowed this guy's personality to just burst out. Yeah. And it's these two, I think, are fantastic together. Mm-hmm. And it's just such great heel heat that he gets. It's the right kind of heat, because when he first came in, people just hated this guy because he didn't represent the ROH style of talent. And I think that's made him that much more effective. And I guarantee this guy's going to get signed at some point by WWE.
Mm-hmm. Well, the WWE, I feel like they're a company that values the ability to speak more so than ability to wrestle. And if you have that, then you're halfway there.
But I think just bringing in Bennett without Maria would be a mistake, because I think she's fantastic.
I don't think they would bring her back.
Especially to the ROH crowd that knows the history of Maria and CM Punk and the way they play it up.
Yeah, yeah.
It's great.
Well, how do they play up? What do they...
They chant like sloppy seconds at her, and they'll chant CM Punk.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure in Bennett's promos, he's even made jokes about Punk and stuff. So, no, it's great. Then our next match, the Briscoe Brothers defending the tag titles against wrestling's greatest tag team. And this match will, this feud will extend to Border Wars, because they're going to have a fight without honor for the tag titles. This feud's been going on forever. And as Mark Briscoe explained in his promo this past weekend on Ring of Honor, feuding with wrestling's greatest tag team, it's been like taking a dump, a large dump, and then you go to wipe, and you've just got to keep wiping and wiping and wiping until it goes away.
That was so good. That was so good. I caught that, too, on the ROH TV this week, and it was just so out of nowhere, because I've seen these ROH commercials as they go to break, where you just have Kevin Kelly, talking to these guys in front of that net or the fence, and a lot of times they're just very standard. I'm gonna go there, I'm gonna beat this guy, and I want to beat him up. But then, like, all of a sudden, this guy hands the mic to Mark Briscoe, and he just starts talking about taking a dump, and this is network TV that I'm watching, and it was great. For the people who've never seen the Briscoes before, how would you describe their character, their style?
Nick and Nate Diaz, which is what everyone compares them to.
Multiplied by 10, I would say.
Yes.
I mean, think Nick and Nate Diaz in a pro wrestling environment, and CM Punk has made that comparison.
These are a bunch of rednecks from Delaware that raise chickens, and they fight.
Yeah, yeah. They are truly unique and appealing characters, I find, like in the current scene, in the current wrestling scene in general. So it's no mystery why the WWE are trying to get their hands on them.
Yeah, they've been under the WWE's radar for a long time. So we go to this match. Haas immediately goes to the floor. They've recently turned heel, and they explain here that the fact that the crowd has never really accepted Haas and Benjamin as their own, and they're perceived as entertainers coming in from the WWE.
Hmm. How do you think they've done so far since their debut? What was it, like 2 years ago now?
They debuted in September of 2010, and they had some great matches with Chris Hero and Claudio Castagnoli. I've enjoyed them, especially Charlie Haas. Charlie Haas has just... You can just see that he has a renewed passion, which I think was gone for the last few years in the WWE. Mm-hmm. It just seems he's really motivated. I think he's great as a heel. Shelton hasn't clicked for me as much of a heel, but he's been one that his personality has never been a strong point for me. Mm-hmm. But Charlie Haas, I think you can really sense a big difference from his time in WWE to now. Haas and Mark are in the ring at the start, and Haas bails when he loses the advantage, and all four begin fighting on the floor. Haas and Benjamin attack the left knee of Jay, and then they work over the knee. They talk about the influence that Arn Anderson has had on wrestling's greatest tag team, and this is then interrupted by the fans chanting same old shit at Haas and Benjamin, and this would be a chant throughout this match towards the heels. Mark flips Benjamin off the top rope from a seated position by his arms for a two count, and Nigel references Robbie Brookside here for that maneuver. And then Benjamin is with Mark, rams his head into the barricade, and eventually busts open Mark as Haas and Benjamin keep him in their corner. Eventually makes the hot tag to Jay, who delivers a super kick to Haas and then a plancha to Benjamin. There's a crossbody off the top to Haas for a two count. And then Haas and Jay trade big boots in the ring back and forth, ending in both of them hitting each other at the same time. They're all down. The fans are chanting ROH. Then Benjamin dives over to the top and rams him face first into the mat. Haas applies the Haas of Pain to Jay, who reaches the ropes. And then Wrestling's Greatest Tag Team, they go to their Leap of Faith backbreaker. And
Faith.
Leap of Faith. And Mark cuts them off. And this leads to Jay just rolling up Charlie Haas for the pin at 16 minutes and 57 and 15 seconds.
Yeah. I thought it was an okay match. This was when I really started to notice the crowd, and I was really thrown off by just how different the crowd sounded. And so in the end, it didn't really feel like a great match to me, but like I feel like if this was in a different venue, it probably would have seemed different.
Yeah, this it was fine. It wasn't the best I've seen from these four. Yeah, kind of built up towards the final bit. The crowd really disliked Charlie Haas, especially. Yeah. But
and what is a match without honor? What is the match that they're gonna have in Toronto?
Fight without honor means no rules.
Okay, so no DQ match.
It'll just be a big brawl.
Okay. Cool.
And that'll, I assume, will be the blow off to this feud.
Hmm.
Afterwards, they attack the Briscoes. Fans are chanting, "You still suck." And then they crotch Jay on the steel post, and then they do it two more times and pose with the titles. There's chance of "You got fired" at Benjamin and Haas, and then Jay is carried to the back, and Kevin Kelly and Nigel, they're in disbelief, and then they discuss other legendary testicle injury angles, including that to Tommy Dreamer and Jerry Lawler at the hands of Bill Dundee.
Mm.
Of course, the testicles have been a popular target among wrestlers in the past, and God, this harkens back to the days of Jerry Lawler.
Yeah. Wow.
So
that's some good history.
Some historical context for a man's testicles being ruptured.
You should make a DVD about that. Greatest testicle injuries.
So we then move on to Kevin Steen against Eddie Edwards in the first three Blind Destiny matches. These were set up on Friday night, where there was going to be three different matches. Sorry, they were going to set up three different matches, and the main event was Davey Richards against Roderick Strong and Eddie Edwards. And all three guys had matches scheduled for Saturday, and whoever won that match would defend the title on Saturday. So you had Kevin Steen, you had Jay Lethal, and you had Michael Elgin all scheduled to have matches with these three, and none of them knowing who would be the champion. So theoretically, any one of those three could get a title match.
Okay.
I'm trying to explain.
No,
this.
You're doing a good job. I'm just trying to visualize it in my head, because it was a little confusing. It was definitely confusing to me when I first heard about this this whole thing. Now after having seen it, so okay, let me get this straight.
It's like you had a three-way on Friday.
Yeah.
And whoever won the title, that would determine who gets to fight the champion.
I see. Okay, yeah, it's pretty easy. So why do they call this a Blind Destiny Challenge match?
Because this match had Eddie Edwards won the title, he was scheduled to face Kevin Steen. These matches were happening regardless.
Okay.
It was just a question of which of these three matches would be the title match.
So then why call it a Blind Destiny Challenge match, since it's a moot point?
Well,
at this point?
I guess.
Okay. All right.
Steen got a strong reaction coming out, and a fan had a Cornette face sign with the Matthew font.
Yes,
I see
that.
And Steen destroyed this sign.
Yeah, this is great. A tale of the tape pops up, and according to this tale of the tape, Kevin Steen coming in at 5'1". Yeah.
Oh, I'm glad you got that.
5'1". Well, what was notable to me was that...
And what was his weight? Like 250?
Yeah.
Well, 5'1", 250.
Well, the thing about it was that, like, the reason I caught it was because, like, the Ring of Honor, by the way, does all these Tale of the Tapes, which I think are cool. They go for, like,
when
very...
you get it right, it's great.
Well, like, here's the thing is, because, like, Kevin Kelly even brings up how... well, first of all, Eddie Edwards is 5'11", and Steen's supposed to be 5'11", so in his commentary, Kevin Kelly says, you can look at the tail of the tape, height, identical. And I'm looking at it, no, it's not. There's a 10-inch advantage here.
Oh,
5 foot.
What
one.
Was more noticeable is when the 10th anniversary show back in March, Eddie Edwards comes out. Here he is in the main event tag match, and it's Edwards is spelt wrong coming out.
Yeah.
Just, man, those are just, they just don't
hey,
look good.
It's, you know, yeah, no, it doesn't. No, this is stuff they definitely have to change if they want to take seriously.
5 foot one, Kevin Steen, yeah. Taking on 5 foot 11, Eddie Edwards. And early on, there's a series of running shoulder blocks by both. And eventually, Edwards goes for a big boot. Steen hits a drop toe hold and then a somersault leg drop on top of Edwards. Steen hits a draping DDT and then a cannonball into the corner. And they go to fight to the floor where Edwards is tossed onto the stage. And Steen goes after his ribs. Edwards runs at him into a powerbomb onto the outside of the apron. Very painful maneuver.
Mm-hmm.
And they fight on the stage. Steen bites Edwards and then seats Edwards and hits a running cannonball onto a chair as he's seated on the stage.
This
margin for error was very small here.
Yeah. I'm assuming this crowd, much of them had already come from the night before, and a lot of them, once they were fighting near the crowd, they were already chanting, off the stage, off the stage. So they were definitely using this high school gym-like stage as a prop in all these matches. And it was cool. Like, it made something different about every venue.
So they fought back to the ring, and Edwards came back first. He kicked Steen off of him, hit a double foot stomp off of the stage to Steen. Back in the ring, hits a chin breaker onto Steen, gets a two count, then runs into a power bomb delivered by Steen. Steen goes for the sharpshooter, but it's blocked, and Edwards applies the half crab. But then Steen rotates to his back and gets a small package, and this was the finish. And he pinned Eddie Edwards at 10:41, and Steen was bleeding from the mouth afterwards, and went to the crowd, put a guy's baseball cap on, then took it off, spit on the guy's hat, and tossed it into the crowd, which is the second most disgusting thing I've seen Kevin Steen do this past week, because did you see his match with Kyle O'Reilly
from the TV? No, I didn't.
They did a spot where he knocked the mouthpiece out of Kyle O'Reilly. Steen picked up the mouthpiece and put it in his mouth and applied an ankle lock. Fucking disgusting.
That's gross.
It was just so fucking gross. But surprise win here. It just came out of nowhere. You would have expected this match would have got a lot of time, but they were adamant after the show went slightly long on Friday. They wanted to be done by 3 hours, and I don't know if the brownout affected times later in the show, wanted your main event to get all of its time in. So this one might have been kind of a victim of that, but a surprise win here, and Kevin Steen goes over clean.
I didn't think that it was. I thought the surprise element was intentional, just to give a win out of nowhere. You don't have to have a finisher and everything. And this wasn't like it wasn't like is a half crab Edwards' finisher?
Yes.
Okay, so then this wasn't out of nowhere. He countered his finisher with a small package. I thought it was a good match.
We go to our next one, and it is Jay Lethal against Roderick Strong in another Blind Destiny Challenge. And Roderick Strong accompanied by Truth Martini, who Kevin Kelly compares to Don King. Truth Martini. And Ciampa comes out with the TV title in a bag, gets on the mic, and goes to return the title after his lawyer, R.D. Evans, had advised him to do so. But first, he says he wants Lethal to be a man and give Roderick Strong a title opportunity tonight. And if Lethal wins, he will hand the title back, shake his hand, and call Lethal the better man. And Lethal calls Ciampa's mouth a dumpster and agrees and says, "You can call me the dominant male after this match," which is Ciampa's moniker.
I thought Ciampa was pretty good here.
Yes. So we get an impromptu title match here between the two. And there was a cool spot here where it was like Lethal applied a figure four to Strong, but using his arms.
Like
and then
Texas Cloverleaf.
Yeah, with like a combination surfboard applied to Roderick. Very cool. Lethal hit a suicide dive to the floor, landed on his feet. They do a big chop fest that the crowd gets into. Strong applies the stronghold, but Lethal gets to the ropes. Lethal hits a handspring back elbow, gets a two count. Then Strong, he goes for a small package, and the crowd really popped for the near fall after that last match where the finish kind of came out of nowhere. And then Lethal counters the Gibson driver, hits a super kick for a two count, and then hits the Lethal combination. Goes to the top for an elbow drop, but only gets a two count after hitting that. He gets drop kicked to the floor, and with the ref's back turned, Ciampa drives Lethal into the post, sends him back into the ring, and Strong hits his vertical suplex onto his knees for the win at 13 minutes and 19 seconds. So we get a new television champion, and Ciampa tosses the title into the ring. And coming out of this, of course, Roderick Strong aligned with the House of Truth.
Mm-hmm. And Roderick Strong, second Triple Crown champ in Ring of Honor history, we're told.
Yes, that's right, because, Lethal was the first.
And go ahead.
Yeah, this match, it was fine.
Yeah, it was okay. I found it a little hard to get into for whatever reason.
From there, we go to the main event, Davey Richards against Michael Elgin, who, another member of the House of Truth, for the ROH title. Davey Richards winning on Friday, and therefore Elgin gets the opportunity on Saturday.
I see.
So, Wei, huge expectations I'm sure you went into this match with.
I really did have huge expectations. I had a lot of everybody tell me, hey, you should be watching this show and or this match. And I don't know if that affected my viewing of it or not. Maybe a little.
There's one common trait I find among matches where you've been told ahead of time that they are, you know, a five-star classic. And it's that usually 10 minutes in, you're thinking to yourself, this is it?
Yeah.
That's what you always feel. And by and large, by the end of the match, I'm convinced. And that's just, usually I go in with expectations, and a lot of the times, like I just, a few months back, watched the Tanahashi-Naito match from New Japan, which everyone was raving about. And by the end of that match, I was like, wow, that was a pretty great match. But, mm-hmm. you know, 5-10 minutes into it, you're like, all right, where's this match of the year candidate?
Right.
It's interesting to watch live versus watching in hindsight once you've seen everyone rave about a match.
I would have definitely loved to have seen this live.
Yeah, the crowd loved this match.
Yeah.
And the commentary, I thought they tried their best to really get Elgin over.
They did. I have to say, though, I thought Nigel was way too excitable towards the end here, just kind of way too out of control. I felt like I think the commentary team has a lot of strong points. I like Kevin Kelly. I think he's a very seasoned professional, and Nigel brings a lot of great historical references to like they speak realistically, you know. They bring up these guys' experiences in the WWE. They bring up like Nigel brings up references to like people from Europe and just people throughout wrestling history, and I really enjoy. But I find that he's still very green. He's still very inexperienced as a commentator, and I thought that was apparent in this match. Just toward the last 10 minutes of this match, I thought Nigel was just way too excited, and he kind of got into that mode where he's just like, can he do it? Can he do it? Over and over again. And I thought it kind of took away from the matchup.
I think one of the toughest skill sets is for an announcer to be able to take their call and take it into a second or third gear for a big finish.
Mm-hmm.
Like, off the top of my head, like a Jim Ross can, like a Joe Rogan, it's very tough because it's not natural for someone to be just screaming with excitement.
Yep. And that's I think having I guess heard a lot of wrestling commentary and having produced some of it for the Fenric myself, it's just I think the difference is just that when you're doing pro wrestling, you sometimes feel the need to play a pro wrestling announcer. And it's different with pro wrestling too, because you're not just calling action. You're fulfilling a part of the storyline. You're a character in there.
Yep.
So you're not just calling action. You're calling it while suspending your own disbelief, trying to be realistic about something that's completely fake. And that you can argue is even more difficult than calling an actual fight or an actual MMA match. I definitely felt like at times here this commentary team was playing their character too much and not so much believing it. I feel like the role of a color commentator, especially, is not to be a narrator. That should be the play-by-play guy. The color guy should be a judge. The color guy should be the authority. You should say, you know, that's good, but and I understand, and they should explain what the people are doing. So these are just kind of my own minor thoughts.
Some highlights from the match. It was about 11 minutes in when they started going for some near falls. And, you know, the crowd was not by any means, you know, off their seats from start to finish. No. I mean, there were some quiet parts in this match.
Mm-hmm. Again, like, I don't know. Like, I wish I was there live. And maybe some people we can respond to us if you were there live to let us know. I have a feeling it could be the way it was mic'd as well. Maybe the way it came across.
From there, let's just look at some of the, Richards. He counters a power bomb off the top that Elgin was attempting, and he goes for the Kimura. The Kimura.
Kimura. Yeah.
And goes for a sunset power bomb. It's blocked by Elgin. He goes back up, and swear to Christ, Davey Richards hit a tiger driver off the top rope to Michael Elgin for a two count. And it was a transition into an ankle lock. And this is a sequence that many fans have totally just dumped on Davey Richards for. That he would do, that these are transition spots. Mm-hmm. And that if there's a knock on Davey Richards, it's that the guy does too much. Personally, I've watched a lot of Davey Richards' big matches, and there are times that, yes, it goes too long. The 10th anniversary show was a perfect example of that. Back in March, even his match with Eddie Edwards back in December, fantastic matches. But when you're hitting that 35-minute mark, it's tough. I thought this match was perfectly timed. I thought this match, I was never bored either time watching this match. But that was, some people have criticized this spot at least. And the crowd is going back and forth chanting Elgin and Davey. They exchange kicks to the head with knees by Elgin to Richards. The crowd started booing Davey when he had the advantage. Elgin hit the Chaos Theory suplex for a two count and then a super kick transitioning to the cross face with Richards making the ropes. Later on, Richards hits a double foot stomp to the floor and then another back in the ring and then hits a spinning lariat. Elgin comes back, goes for an inverted suplex and drops Richards on his head. And Nigel, I thought here was he was trying to really get across Michael Elgin as having the match of his career here. And there was a powerbomb into the corner by Elgin, who comes back for a spinning powerbomb, but it's countered into the ankle lock. There was a really cool spot where Davey came back. He got the left leg, transitioned to the ankle lock. Elgin is selling, eventually rolls through. Davey winds up, hits the Shining Wizard, and Elgin kicks out at one and just does this crazy All Japan spot where he gets back to his feet and is just roaring up and kicking out of a one count, and the crowd went nuts for that spot. And Richards comes back, hits a series of kicks. Elgin goes down to his knees, and he takes a spinning kick to the head, and Richards pins him. 26 minutes and 22 seconds. I thought this match was awesome. I love this match.
Yeah.
I thought it was really good. I wasn't as negative on the commentary. I thought I think Nigel's progressed a lot from when he started, but I can see where you're coming from. But I thought this was just a star-making performance from Michael Elgin. Like, this took him to another level, and within the ROH audience, seeing this guy as one of the top guys instead of just one of the guys.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, fine match. I thought... this was a very, very much a Japanese style matchup with a ton of stiff looking shots, and I myself kind of felt sore even just watching it.
So this concluded the show, and then afterwards Davey Richards cuts a promo. He says that he's given his body to MMA, but his heart and soul to pro wrestling, and that we're all family. Says the real wrestling took place Friday and today in Fort Lauderdale, and kind of takes a bit of a jab at Orlando and Connecticut. Which leads to a fuck TNA chant. Says the real champion in this ring is Michael Elgin, and that one day he will have this title, but not right now. And puts Elgin over. Says we just had a match of the year candidate, and it was mostly because of this guy. And learned when he faced Samoa Joe and Brian Danielson that you can get a lot further along with the fans' support rather than Truth Martini. And he thanks the fans. And Kevin Kelly, in his tribute to Gordon Soley, ends the show by saying so long from the Sunshine State.
Cool.
So, paced by a phenomenal main event. This was a good Ring of Honor show. Definitely the highlight was the main event. You take out the main event, I've seen them a lot better from Ring of Honor. But that main event was a total match of the year candidate. And probably going to get a ton of votes at the end of the year.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. No doubt.
And your thoughts overall, out of a 10 way, where does this one rank?
Overall, I mean, I feel like I'd probably enjoy the show a lot more if I was more familiar with the people, more familiar with the characters, and also if I was there live. Watching a snipped down version of it on the internet without maybe the best sounding atmosphere, I have to give it a 7. But that's, don't take that as any indicator of how the show actually probably was in another setting.
Well, I'm going to agree with you and give it a 7 out of 10. That's where I felt this one went. And I want to go to this interview that we did back over Wrestle Reunion weekend with Michael Elgin. If some of you missed this interview, here is myself and Wei chatting with Michael Elgin, this being just 2 weeks after this match with Davey Richards and how big of a match this was in his career. We are now being joined by a man that... I think is going to be on the ballot for just about everyone's match of the year candidate, coming off a huge match in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Michael Elgin joining us here at Wrestle Reunion. And Mike, thanks for joining us here on our live podcast from Wrestle Reunion. This is going out to the entire world.
Sounds good. Thank you for having me, guys.
Tell us a bit about the match with Davey Richards, because that, a lot of people looking at, I mean, do you feel that this is almost a turning point in your career where I think people look at you now instead of, you know, just solid performer in Ring of Honor, a key guy now, I think, in that top end mix? I mean, did it feel like this was a career defining match for you?
Yeah, you know what? It really did. Like, I knew going into the weekend that all the eyes in the wrestling world were in Florida that weekend, and I just had the mindset that I had to do something special so I could be looked at in that main event light and more people would pay attention to what I'm doing.
Was it a case that as soon as it was over, you and Davey kind of knew we did something really special here, or was it something that it was when you saw the reaction, whether it be online or in the newsletters? I mean, tell us a bit about after the
fact. Like the crowd... The crowd reaction really helped support that we did something special there. And then when we got to the back, everybody's reactions to it. So that was big. I think it was kind of with the crowd reaction and with the people in the back telling us how much they enjoyed it, it really, really put on us that it was something special.
I don't know how much you follow Dave Meltzer's newsletter, but they gave your match 5 stars, which is a rarity here. I mean, covering the industry as long as Dave Meltzer has, I mean, is that a, you know, just to see the, you know, the reaction, not just of your peers, but everybody across the board, that this, that was not only the match of the weekend for everyone in Miami, but I think everyone's match of the year at this point.
Yeah, you know what? I don't really get to read any of that stuff. I try not to because sometimes it changes your opinion and everything. But I have a lot of friends that I grew up with that never got into wrestling that said they wanted to, but they still follow it. So I got a lot of people sending me quotes and everything, and it's still kind of surreal. I mean, for people to look at it like that means a great deal to me. You know, I put everything I have into wrestling, and I'm just glad that people accepted it the way they did.
Is it something for you that a lot of people, especially when you come back here to Toronto, that have just seen your career progress so much? Like, I remember seeing you in Oshawa back in 2006. You look at just the progress. It's do you ever have that time where you kind of look back and it's like, man, look at my roots here and where I've become now as someone that is, you know, known worldwide at this point with this exposure?
Yeah, I mean, you always want to look back and see where you came from and what you've done along the years. It's just, as I said, it's just kind of all sinking in, you know what I mean? I've been working really hard at it, everything, whether it be in-ring-wise or in the gym or whatever. It's a long process to really get yourself prepared to be on a big stage and finally get into Ring of Honor. I knew I needed those moments and those matches to really set myself apart from everybody else. So looking back, it's good that I took the route that I did, and now I'm here, and I'm happy to be here.
What's a bit of the process like? Because you're someone now working with Ring of Honor and with the deal they have with the Sinclair Broadcast Group. Tell us a bit about preparing for television matches versus just live events where you're under the constraints of time and just kind of adjusting your style to that format.
Yeah, I think the biggest adjustment is time. You really can't risk going over. You don't want to go under because you want to be on TV as much as you can be. But you got to – that's the biggest change is you got to make sure you don't want to be a couple seconds over or a minute over anything because it messes up later on in the card, and you don't want to take away from anybody else who's also trying to shine out there on TV. So I'd say that that's definitely the biggest thing to get used to is really strict time restraints.
Any great Jim Cornette stories that you have been witness to? I heard he had quite a blow-up at the GFL people. Confirm
yes.
or deny.
He definitely did. It was fun to see. But really, he's been very calm. More so, I just hear the stories of him telling us when he would blow up. But that was one of the rare times since I've been with Ring of Honor that I've actually witnessed it.
Have you? I'm sure you have. Have you seen the Dairy Queen video? Because
I have seen it.
Thanks
yes.
to YouTube, moments like that live forever.
Yeah, that's great. I don't know if it was on par with that. It might have been, but it was pretty good to see.
Tell us a bit about what you're going to be doing tonight. You're going to be working with Alpha One. It's coming up at 7:30 here at the Doubletree Hotel, right before the Evolve show here.
Yeah, I mean, I've worked with Alpha One here in Ontario quite a bit, and I really feel that Ontario has so much talent that nobody gets to see. And when they said that they were doing the show, we talked and worked something out so I could be on it and just, you know, work with somebody from around here that I've known for a long time. And I just want people to see the talent that Ontario has, so I was looking forward to doing it.
Do you feel now you're kind of in a role now where, I mean, Michael Elgin gets a lot of attention now that you're able to bring back to Ontario and see some of the guys that are coming up, you know, that there's a whole crop of guys coming out of Ontario, and now you're able to kind of take your position in the industry and kind of shine that spotlight a bit? Because Michael Elgin, I think a lot of people now, with all the buzz coming, you know, just off of that match, for instance, are probably going to come check this out tonight.
Yeah, you know what? I'm really hoping that that's the case. I'm a firm believer that wherever I've been, even when I started like in Michigan and Ohio and stuff, that Ontario has a core group of talent all in one area. It's very rare that you find the guys who, you know, aren't so good, that aren't capable of making it. And with Ontario, as I said, there's so much talent here that the world really needs to see it so they can get the chance out on a bigger level. And I'm hoping that maybe I can help with that. Maybe I can't, but if I do, I'm glad that I can help some people out.
We'll just keep you a few more minutes here, but last year we traveled to Nunavut with you, and I know at that time you were really big into Dr. Death, Steve Williams. I'm curious, who are some of the influences right now that you're getting into?
Still Dr. Death, Terry Gordy, Stan Hansen, a lot of Japanese wrestling, you know, Kenta Kobashi's, Misawa's, Kawada's, a lot of that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's really evident in your style, just kind of taking bits and pieces from them and kind of making it your own.
Absolutely.
Which I guess is obviously the goal here, kind of make it your own, and kind of there's so many different influences out there. As well, my last question here is just, we were talking earlier just about how tape trading's almost been replaced now by everything is digital now. It's, when a lot of guys were breaking into the business, it was trying to just get tapes of guys. How much has that made it, you know, just for you, you want to go seek out Dr. Death stuff, you could spend an entire week watching his stuff online.
Yeah, you know what, it's a blessing, really. I mean, it was so hard before. I remember when I was young and me and my friend would trade tapes all the time, all over the place. I mean, I have literally probably 15 boxes that hold about 100 tapes each.
Wow.
Just filled with wrestling tapes. And it is so much easier, and you get so much more time. I mean, with your phone now, you can watch wrestling on the road.
Yeah.
You can put it onto your iPod, and it really is a saving grace. You know, flights, places, it just passes the time to watch some wrestling and stuff, and there's so much out there that you can just get your hands on now.
Well, we look forward to catching you tonight. It'll be on the Alpha One show coming up at 7:30 here at the Doubletree Hotel, 655 Dixon Road, and catch this man on Ring of Honor Television. It airs all throughout Southern Ontario or wherever you are watching. Check your local listings there, ROHWrestling.com, and anywhere else where listeners can follow Michael Elgin online.
You can check me on Facebook at Michael Elgin, and then Twitter is at ROH Michael Elgin.
Awesome stuff. And we are in the midst of production on our documentary we shot last year, and Michael Elgin, a huge focus of that, and that's going to be, we'll have more news on that in the coming weeks. And Mike, thanks very much for sitting
Thank
with
for
us. Look
guys.
Forward to
I
checking out tonight.
It.
And congratulations on the match with Davey.
Thank you.
So that was Michael Elgin discussing his match of the year candidate with Davey Richards, which was the top match people were talking about coming off of a WrestleMania weekend for those that checked out all of the events going on in the Miami area that weekend. So now let's transition over to your feedback. And Wei, do you want to start things off with our feedback?
No.
Okay. Well, I'm going to pull up the feedback because I don't have it here. But for anyone out there that wants to post on our...
I don't know if we even have one.
We do. Yes, we do. We just have to find it here at lawradio.proboards.com. Yeah, where is it?
I just don't... Did you make one?
I did make one, and we had... There it is. Go under latest shows.
Latest shows. Okay.
I put it in the wrong section.
All right.
All right. Let's start with The Waithiest. I ordered the two-night pay-per-view thanks to Ring of Honor, doing what I felt was a great job selling it to me. The technical difficulties were a complete nightmare for the first night and the first half of the second show. I was pissed and firing off emails and tweets to anyone with ROH or Go Fight Live to get a refund. The wrestling was great, though, and then Richards and Elgin happened. I marked out watching wrestling for the first time in ages. Before it started, I didn't give a shit because it was obvious who would win. Then, as the match went along, I found myself cheering for Elgin and thinking he might win. Kelly and Nigel did a fantastic job calling the match, and Richards, who I generally don't like all that much, and especially Elgin, were fantastic. Otherwise, Steen was great as always. Strong's win was a surprise, but not a bad one. All in all, a pretty strong show with an instant classic main event, 8 out of 10. That was from Brett C.
For Mark McCreath, this is the first ROH event I've watched in a while, and I thought it was a good show. My highlights were Kevin Steen in the 5-star main event. I thought Steen was brilliant with both his fat man high spots and his interaction with the crowd. The main event was a fantastic match, and it made Elgin look like a champion in waiting. My only problem with the match was the finish. After 25 minutes or so of a great back-and-forth match with many near falls, Elgin hulks up and makes a comeback. He is then kicked in the head a few times, and it's over. I wasn't expecting the match to end when it did, and thought it was going to take something out of the ordinary to get the win. Before I watched this event, I had no idea what a Blind Destiny challenge match was, and after watching the event, I still have no idea what it is. The announcers could have at least explained it. I wasn't into this event till the last three matches, which were all very good, so I would give this show a 7 out of 10.
Next up, I was coming into this cold, and I haven't been watching ROH for the last 6 or 7 months because I would have to go out of my way to download it, and the shows weren't strong enough to make me go out of my way to see it. I thought the undercard was really average, and the standout highlight being the tag match between the Briscoes and Wrestling's Greatest Tag Team. Again, this showed me I really wish the WWE would invest more in their tag division. They could literally just steal the tag division from ROH as it is, and it would immediately work and add so much variety to their shows and their lackluster undercards. They seem to have made progress with the quality of production since I last saw them, which is a good sign. They still make sloppy mistakes, though, like not lining up the name key to the wrestlers as they enter. Haas and Benjamin still have the belts in their photo, leaving the camera on McGuinness and Kelly when they weren't saying anything. I'm obviously nitpicking, and it's not a big deal, but they are really sloppy errors, and it's not like it would cost money to fix those errors. So you kind of lack sympathy with them when the small issues seem to stem from just not having a strong enough attention to detail. Like I say, it's not even a big deal, and I'm not such a snob I'm going to pretend it took away from my viewing enjoyment. They're just things I noticed. On to the main event, which lived up to the expectations put on from the people who saw the match before me. Technically, it was superb. They hit every move perfectly, and transitions were great. Elgin came off looking like a star. I did think it lost its way a bit towards the end with all the crossfaces and ankle locks and continual kicks, and I didn't like Kevin Kelly's commentary. I hate when commentators say this is the greatest ever while the match is still going on. I'd like my commentators to stay in the moment rather than take me out of it explaining the wider context of what we're seeing. This should be done post-fight, in my opinion. Anyway, they are small things. It was a 5-star match and one of the best I've seen. A question for me is, why do they do so much no-selling of moves and strikes? As a mainstream wrestling fan myself, I normally don't see it, and it was a bit strange. Is it to be realistic like MMA, or just a historical Japanese thing?
Well, I see it like a Japanese thing.
I think it's definitely that's where the influence comes from. And to me, there's no formula when it comes to me, that crowd was going insane here for the finish. And if that style works for an audience, then it works. Then it gets over.
It's a Japanese thing. It's a thing for a reason. And that's because it seems to drive a lot of excitement within the audience. It's a device to use.
You don't want to use it in every match, but for a big match, yeah. I'm fine with it.
Totally. And we thank you for all of your feedback. You can always leave it at lawradio.proboards.com. And John,
next week, Wei, we're going on a journey. It is coming up on May 19th, and how else could we possibly celebrate that day of the year rather than review WWE Films' first release of Journey into Darkness, the 2006 release on Kane.
Journey into Darkness?
Isn't that what it's called?
I thought it was See No Evil.
Oh, you're right. You know what? I think Journey into Darkness was the book on Kane or something like that.
Right.
So,
we won't be reviewing that. We are reviewing See No Evil, May 19th.
Fantastic. So that's going to be coming up, everyone, next week as we review See No Evil, a movie I cannot even remember. So we will chat about that next week.
What the fuck is Journey into Darkness?
Search it right now because I'm just remembering
something. Okay, yes, it is The Unauthorized History of Kane.
Oh, okay, right. That's where it was.
There we go.
I knew it had something to do with Kane. There's too many...
No, we're reviewing the movie. And who?
The movie.
Who's joining us?
We are tentatively scheduled to be joined by Dan Madigan, former WWE writer and the screenwriter of See No Evil.
Oh.
So he is going to join us to chat about his experience writing this movie and working with Glenn Jacobs, because he was involved in a number of Kane's angles at the time. So Dan will be chatting with us next week. You can leave your feedback at lawradio.proboards.com. We'll be putting a thread up later this weekend. And then next Wednesday, that is what we will be chatting with. But lots of stuff coming up this week. We've got two shows coming up on Thursday with a chat with Kevin Kelly, as well as an ROH Border Wars preview with myself and Dan Lavransky. Review and Impact Friday. And then Sunday, we will be chatting On the Law, reviewing TNA Sacrifice, and hearing from Dick the Destroyer Buyer on his new biography that he has just put out. So lots of stuff coming up your way. Keep it tuned to liveaudiowrestling.com. lawradio.proboards.com and add way on draw something.
No, don't do that. Add you can add John Pollock on all the things that John Pollock does.
Sure, why not? Way, why don't you leave us with some music?
Well, this might seem like a bit of an odd choice.
There's no such thing.
For Ring of Honor. I'd like to. We used to air Ring of Honor on this channel, and they would always start with this opening, and there used to be a theme song for these openings. I don't know if they. I never bought the DVD, so I don't know if this was ever on the DVDs. But these shows that they would send to us would always have this opening video, and it would be this kind of 80s type of synth pop type of song, and nothing that crazy about it. Until one day, I discovered this band named Sparks. Who are almost like a synth pop band from the 80s, and there's a song that sounded exactly like this Ring of Honor theme. So for those of you that are familiar with the Ring of Honor theme, here are Sparks with the Tryouts for the Human Race. Enjoy.
Wow.